Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. Today we're talking with filmmakers Mark and Jay Duplass, who made a movie called Baghead.
Yeah, we like the term mumblecore when it appears in print in the New York Times.
This is Robert Davis. You know, one of my favorite movies at Sundance this year was a little movie called Baghead by Mark and Jay Duplass. It's about these four out-of-work actors who go to a film festival, see a terrible movie, and decide, hey, we could write something like that. And so they decide to spend the weekend at a cabin in the woods writing a screenplay for themselves. So this is very funny. And then once they get out there in the cabin in the woods, it starts to shift into something a little bit creepy, too. I really liked this unusual combination. It seems like the Duplass brothers are satirizing a movement in American film called mumblecore. And if it seems like they know that world well, well, it's because they're a part of it. The Duplass brothers, along with filmmakers like Andrew Pajalski and Joe Swanberg, are making extremely low-budget movies with their friends, movies that are very improvisational, talky, tend to be about relationships, and movies that have to be very clever because of their low budgets in order to be interesting. And luckily, these filmmakers actually are making pretty interesting movies. Today on the podcast, J. Robert Parks talks with the Duplass brothers about how they make their movies and about what they're up to next. But first, a bit of business. Did we change the name of the podcast? Yes, thank you for noticing. We did change the name of the podcast. It's now called The Plastic Podcast. And we've given the podcast a new name because we've given the podcast a new home. You can now find us on the web at dailyplastic.com. Daily? Did I say daily? Okay. All right, we'll go daily with this, dailyplastic.com. And there you'll find the same sort of blend of movies that we talk about on the podcast, both obscure foreign films, favorite classics, and big blockbusters. If you go to movies on the weekends, be sure to check out the movie grid to see what we think of what's out there. If you're subscribed to the Errata Movie Podcast in iTunes, don't worry, you don't have to do anything. You'll automatically transition to the Plastic Podcast. We're really just changing the name. If you're not a subscriber, it's actually really easy to do and it's free. Just go to dailyplastic.com and click on the subscribe in iTunes link. And what this does is it makes your iTunes automatically download each episode as it's available, so you don't have to go hunting for it. And the other thing it does is it gives you chapter stops, so that if you're listening to the podcast in iTunes or on your iPod or iPhone, then you can jump around easily to the parts that are interesting to you, or skip spoilers, or skip things that you find boring. So it's worth a click. Now, since J. Robert is talking to two different people today on the podcast, we wanted to make sure that their voices were distinct. So we asked Mark and Jay to introduce themselves, and here's what they said.
I'm Mark Duplass of Duplass Brothers fame, and welcome to the greatest podcast of all time.
I am Jay Duplass. I am Mark Duplass's brother, and I'm very excited to be here.
And here's J. Robert Parks.
I want to start with a general question. Do you like the term mumblecore?
We may be one of the few filmmakers associated with the movement that don't hate the term mumblecore. I don't know if we can necessarily say we like it, but we're pretty aware of the benefits of being lumped into a movement. You know, I think the easiest thing in the world is just to be like, I'm way more individual and I will not be lumped into any movement. And I mean, I guess we do feel that way on some level, but you know, we're all making little movies, and little movies need attention and they need to be written about. And I think it's cool that, like, you know, some people decide to put a name on it and talk about our movies, because we kind of need that. I mean, that being said, Jay and I feel pretty specifically that our movies, although they share some of the aesthetic qualities of the mumblecore movement, at their core they're very different, and that our movies are very plot driven and they're very genre driven, and we like movies that are really like obeying those genre rules and barreling towards their climax. They just kind of are wearing shaggy clothes almost, you know. So there's a difference, but you know, if the New York Times wants to write articles about us, like, we're not going to say no.
Yeah, we like the term mumblecore when it appears in print in the New York Times.
Yeah. How did you hit upon this style? Is this something that you sort of had thought about, or just sort of as you were doing your short films?
It was definitely a total accident of, you know, we came from film school and procedural filmmaking and loading, you know, CP 16 millimeter cameras and spending 90% of your time on technical aspects. And all of our movies were bad and they didn't work and they were derivative. And
I think when you spend 90% of your time on the technical aspects of a film and you're not focused on the story and the acting for the types of movies we want to make, which are personal stories, your movies are about 10% good.
Yeah. So we had to kind of reverse it, but we didn't like do it consciously. It just kind of, we were just miserable one day and Mark was like, we're going to just make a movie today. And I was like, what are you talking about? We don't have any film, you know? And he's like, no, we'll just use like mom and dad's video camera. And so we ended up just sort of like shooting this improv thing. And the story was based on something that had happened to us previously, which is trying to perfect the personal greeting of your answering machine, and failing to do so. And you know, it really just kind of came from like making that movie, and it went to Sundance and it got rave reviews and it cost $3. And we were like, oh, this is what we should be doing. And now in retrospect, we're aware that like what we're doing in film is we're making fun of ourselves on film. We're exploiting like the private conversations that Mark and I always have between us about the cringeworthy things that like ourselves and our friends do and our family does, you know, and those conversations usually start with like, oh, cringe, you know, like cringing and like, and then it like will spill into laughter afterwards. And that's kind of like how we ended up with this style. I mean, the documentary digital video style of shooting started first with just like a budgetary concern, but we've since basically figured out that, you know, the verite or documentary style, I think definitely adds to the immediacy and the sort of like, I don't know, just like the everyday lifeness of like what it is that we're trying to capture.
Mumblecore strikes me as a particularly good approach to capturing the weirdness and the cringeworthiness of unrequited love, which comes up in Baghead. And I was curious how much of that was in the script that you guys did and how much of that sort of develops in the course of filming.
We knew that Chad had a crush on Michelle and that he would have an uphill battle in this movie. So the archetype of that dynamic we had set up very well in the script. But the little specifics and how that stuff would happen, those things usually came up in the improvisation in the moment, you know. And it's definitely our firm belief that if you allow your actors a little bit of freedom and you trust your actors and they're, you know, good, self-aware, loving people, that they're going to come up with great stuff. So all the little specifics that happen, all the little kind of lightning strikes were usually springing out of the looseness of the moment.
You guys mentioned in another interview that you don't like the word spoof, that you don't want to seem like you're making fun of people. And yet the movie seems to at least poke fun at this idea that anyone can just write a script in a weekend. I'm curious how you guys write.
We used to write like that. and
I guess the only spoofing we're doing is directly of ourselves.
Yeah.
Everybody else, we're like,
you're clean.
You're clean. Yeah, we get it.
But we write pretty quickly now. We tend to we realize that the most important thing for our movies is a nice, solid structure, and good, strong characters. Almost, even though this sounds terrible, almost caricatures. Which can later be fleshed out through the improvisation. But having like a rock solid foundation really helps us, you know, sort of like I said, drive us towards that climax. So we put all our scenes down on note cards, get them in a row, and then we speak the script out into a dictaphone real quickly over the course of usually less than a week. And then once you get it on paper, then we kind of go to the other side of the brain, trim it up a little bit. But we don't fuss too much on making jokes or making the dialogue quippy, because we know we're going to improvise a bit, and we just make sure the bedrock is there.
How much do the characters change over the course of that improvisation? In other words, when you came up with the idea of Baghead, how different was that than what you what the result was with Baghead?
I mean, structurally, it's pretty much the same throughout. We do shoot in shooting order so that we can adjust to any of the details that might change. In terms of the characters, I think the characters do change quite a bit in terms of their nuances and just what's going on subtextually with them. In terms of their actions and their motivations and the sort of like what Mark and I call the A-plot, like that remains, like, you know, we work with objectives on set, and those people, they need to get that thing done. How they get it done, the passive-aggressive means, who they might employ to get that thing done, that will change, and that's something that we, you know, consider and have late-night conversations about throughout the filming process, you know, just so that we can stay on top of making sure that, you know, it's not a totally schizophrenic approach. But
we'll also focus a little bit more, a little bit less on certain relationships based on the existing chemistry between the actual actors too. You know, if there's a special thing happening, and, you know, then we'll start to point the camera a little bit more in that direction rather than say, you guys were supposed to be in love. Let's see more of that. If it's not as much as what we thought, we just take what we've got going for us and kind of, you know, point the laser on the truth of what's happening rather than try and mold it into something that's not.
You guys worked with a little bit more professional actors this time than you did in the puffy chair. How is that different, or how is it the same?
It's pretty much the same. I mean, basically the actors in this movie just had a little more film experience. But, you know, if anything, we've just found that lots of film experience on our sets does not, if anything, it will translate into breaking down patterns of acting that people might get into, because there are just certain skills you have to develop on big movie sets that can get in the way of just like being completely vulnerable, being completely open to anything happening in that moment.
I think a good example would be like if you read a script over and over again and you study it and you study those lines, you memorize those lines, you prepare yourself to have an emotion in that scene, and you're prepared to go in and you know that when this line happens, it's supposed to make you feel a certain way. So you get locked into that rather than actually just obeying whatever you're getting from the person across from you. And it's the standard thing of acting versus reacting. We're looking for our actors just to react to whatever they're getting in the room, as opposed to have any sort of, you know, prepared emotion. And you should prepare things on a big movie set, because a lot of times you're acting with a stand-in, you know? So it's just it's not a bad thing. It's just not what works on our set.
How much of the tone that you guys achieve in Backhead, and I think one of the great things about the film is it has this really cool use of tone, but how much of that is achieved in the editing process?
Editing is kind of everything on in our movies, particularly with a movie like Backhead, where there's, you know, we want there to be a nice focus on the relationships there and really care about the characters. We want it to be funny and we want it to be scary too. And
I mean, directorially, we were terrified that we weren't going to accomplish that unified tone, and we were afraid it was going to be three different animals. But directorially, we prepare ourselves in our footage and do lots of different options so that we just try and stay aware of it, and we don't really know exactly what it's going to be, but we have inklings and we have hints, and so we get different options, and it doesn't come together until finally in editing.
And so in the editing room, are you sort of playing with even different order of scenes, or just the way certain scenes are cut?
It's mostly about the way certain scenes are cut, and in particular, we will have literally shot sometimes two or three different versions of that scene where different things happen. And our editor calls it the choose-your-own-adventure form of filmmaking, you know? So it's kind of our belief that if you have an instinct on set, you should follow it, but you should probably also shoot the original version just in case you got oatmeal brain from being exhausted and it was a bad idea. So we just have those options when we're, you know, when the brain is a little more kind of on par.
One of the things I love about Backhead is that it assumes an intelligent audience, you know, an audience that is aware of film genres, an audience that is aware of sort of the expectations we have with certain kinds of movies, and then that you play with those expectations. I assume that's intentional, but how did you sort of approach that in thinking about your audience?
We definitely are aware of the meta aspects of the movie, and but honestly, like, primarily on set, we just focus on the microcosm of what's going on, and just sort of towing the line of, like, I don't know, it's we have a lot of conversations about where the audience is at this very moment, so it's not so much about like a sweeping idea of like how do they, you know, it just comes down to little tiny moments. It's like, where are they right now? They're probably going to be thinking this.
Yeah, we just try to ask that question of just like, is the audience ahead of us? And if there's any doubt that they might actually be getting ahead of us, then we tend to reel back, you know, and then we test the film.
We'll show them less
in terms of giving them information and how much we give them,
or we'll say look over here, you know what I mean, and but the things over here.
So what we do is we tend to test the movie first with very very little information, and then ask people questions and see what they didn't get, and then we start to slowly add back things just to give it the minimum amount necessary in terms of exposition and whatnot, so that the movie can still move forward.
Yeah, we start with the most subtle, most challenging version of the movie that like would be our dream of, like, you know, people are barely hanging on by a thread, but we do find that we have to add some things in, and that not always is a product of like we're just too good for our audiences. Sometimes our filmmaking is not like we won't have pulled something off with the clarity that we thought we would, so we have to drop a little bomb over here to release information, you know.
Are you guys testing with friends, or are you testing with just sort of random people?
The goal for us is we'd love to be all random people, but then you don't really know what kind of person you're getting.
We also can't afford that.
Yeah, we can't afford that. So we ask sort of friends who know us to bring someone who absolutely doesn't know us, but they think is a, you know, normal, trustworthy person with no like socio-political religious hang-ups that would make them, you know, a not objective audience member.
But our questionnaires are notoriously painstakingly long, and some of the questions in our questionnaires are, they're all anonymous, and the main questions are, do you know us? Are you friends with us?
You think Jay is cute?
Yeah.
Because
a couple
of,
like, we just want to, like, you know, and then we have to take that with a grain of salt. So
I read in a different interview that you guys have noticed that Baghead plays differently with a big audience than with a small audience. And I'm curious why you think that is.
Well, there's certainly this permission to laugh thing that happens in our movies that we saw with the Puffy Chair as well. They're a little awkward. They're a little strange. You're not quite sure to accept some of these moments. So the more people are in a theater, the more they tend to play like comedies, because someone laughs first and breaks the ice, so to speak. There's another unforeseen factor with Baghead, which is the night and day factor also, where, you know, our day screenings tend to be more comedic and our night screenings tend to play really scary. You know, we had a midnight secret screening in Austin, and it was like we were watching Halloween in 1978. People were screaming. A woman got up and ran out of the theater. You know, that was a real surprise to us because, you know, after having sat with the movie for 50 viewings, it's not scary to us anymore by any means, you know.
One of the things that I've thought about a lot as a critic over the last 10 years is just how the people I'm with in whatever screening room affects my own viewing. And it's for me as a critic, I want to pretend that I'm objective about these things. And yet the fact of the matter is I'm not, you know. And I saw Baghead with a pretty small press screening, but it was people who really got it. Mm-hmm. And so we just had a lot of fun and we were just laughing a lot. And I'm sure that on a different day, it might not have worked quite as well, you know, if you caught people in a grumpy mood or whatever.
Yeah, had you watched that on DVD in the 90 minutes before you were supposed to do the interview while you were eating lunch, it certainly would have been a different experience. It's weird. Jay and I, we always get the question from people like, what's your favorite movie of all time? And we've had to create two categories, which is like favorite movie and then favorite viewing experience, you know?
Christmas 1994, Dumb and Dumber.
Nothing beats that, yeah.
Potentially, I mean...
I was 16, I think.
Yeah. I was 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, potential emergency room, intercostal, splitting.
I have a really embarrassing one, which was when I was 20 years old, I was about to go on my first tour as a musician. And, like, I was, you know, very melodramatic about the adventure I was heading out on. And I saw Titanic, and I wept copiously because I perceived myself headed out on that boat. And, like, that was a phenomenal viewing experience. And then I look back on the movie, and I'm like, what's wrong with me? Like, what happened there?
Yeah, Mark and I also both have been obsessed with Joe vs. the Volcano from the moment it came out when we were kids. And it struck us at some point. We're aware that most people think that it's not even a movie. You know what I'm saying? Like, people are like...
I don't even know if that qualifies as a movie, but we're just like...
Then we went back and we're like, that's John Patrick Shanley.
Yeah.
Like, he wrote and directed
But it was
movie.
Pure magic to us at some point, and it's like, it kind of remains pure magic because it brings us back to... So, yeah, objective movies, it's a weird thing.
There are movies from my teenage years like Fletch. You know, I'm never going to claim that Fletch is some sort of, you know, hallmark of comedy.
I will.
But I can watch that 40, you know, times in a year. It's well, let me ask the other question then. What are your favorite movies, not the viewing experiences?
The pure ones that stick around a lot are you know, Raising Arizona and the first Rocky film. And we love American Movie a lot. That's a very inspirational to us. That Mark Borchardt is a character, the sweetness, the desperation, the hilariousness, the heart that he
and
has.
And the genius.
And the genius, you know, is like what we're striving to get in a lot of our characters. And we don't get close, but, you know, I mean, that the way that you love Mark Borchardt, the complexity of that is just, that's amazing.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
Jay Hoberman has a great quote, I think, about mumblecore in general. He says, tension is less a function of narrative than a perpetual state of being. how does that apply in your films, do you think?
I guess the biggest difference that we feel between ourselves and mumblecore is that we do employ plot and are obsessed with plot and are constantly like reinventing our plots and trying to make them as challenging as possible along the way. So we do employ tension in that way. That being said, we feel like if we don't settle into three or four really like critical scenes between two individuals and mind the tension in that, then our movies are failed. We feel like that is paramount. That is sort of what, like, I guess, makes our movies. And it does come from, not from plot, but from, like, I mean, plot's underneath there for sure. You know the intentions, you know where things are going, but it does come from that unexpected place that you find yourself in a scene where something's going down and you just, everything hinges on it.
Also, the actors are never fully comfortable in any of our scenes because they are improvising and they don't know what they're going to get hit with, you know. So there's always the sense of anything might happen that keeps people just a little bit on that, you know, shaking hand place.
There are a lot of brother writer-director duos. Do you guys...
None as good as us.
Oh, well, of course. That goes without saying. And how do you guys work?
We are incredibly nice to each other and respectful, and we don't really fight or disagree very, very much. There's a slight division of labor that's starting to develop where this is Mark, by the way, I will focus a little more on the front end of the movie in terms of like the producing stuff and the getting it on its feet and giving it that life and momentum, and I'll write some of maybe the early drafts, and Jay will quality control all that stuff. And then during the movie, we're kind of directing together, and, you know, just maybe one of us will develop a special relationship with a certain actor and we'll tend to talk to them a little bit more, but we're mostly in it together. And then the back end of the movie, Jay and our editor, Jay Doobie, and our assistant editor, John Fletcher, now kind of get together and, like, banging out, and I'll be saved later for more objective, you know, viewpoint on what the cuts will be.
You guys utilize a low budget and really effective, I think, in interesting ways. But I'm curious what you would do if you had a larger budget, how you would do things differently.
Pay stars to be in the movies and pay everyone really, really well. I mean, that would be the goal, is to keep the process the same, I think. Maybe pay us too.
You talked about movies that you really like. What filmmakers have influenced you?
Well, I would say definitely like in the early 80s when we just became obsessed with movies and cable came to our neighborhood, it was just like, you know, early 80s relationship movies like Romancing the Stone and like Continental Divide. We've been talking about that movie. Just like ridiculous movies that, you know,
7-year-olds shouldn't be watching.
Seven and 10-year-olds shouldn't be watching, but that's what we were watching. But then towards like high school and college, we wanted to be the Coen brothers. I mean, we were just like, my God, these guys are just gods.
and we tried to be them and we failed miserably. And it's weird because now, I mean, we definitely, I mean, it's not like we exist in a vacuum, but like we were telling you before, the way that we accidentally came up with that movie, it was a total accident, and it really was completely bereft of any conscious referencing. It was really just like, let's make a movie about the shit we talk about.
Yeah, it was functionality, you know? And desperation.
It was like, yeah,
just plain and simple.
That being said, I mean, I think like the biggest influences on us are documentaries and like American movie, because that's what we want to do. That's what we want, to put stuff on screen that's like the depth of human beings and the funniness of it all and like the ridiculousness of it all, and for people to feel that it's real. And that's kind of basically what we're obsessed with. So I think documentaries are the biggest influence on what we're doing. We'd probably make documentaries if you could like earn a living doing it, and if it didn't take 7 years to make each movie. We had too short attention span for that.
It's a standard question towards the end of interviews to ask what's coming next, but I'm particularly interested in what you guys hope to do both short-term and long-term, whether you see yourself continuing this kind of style for 10, 15 years, or whether you see it changing over time.
We got really excited when Hollywood became interested in us, and we sold a bunch of scripts and pitches to them for things that we would one day direct. But are now starting to get more realistic about, like, that was really exciting money-wise, but we're not sure we're actually going to be able to make the movies the way we want to make them inside the studio system. Our process and their process are very far apart. And so we're kind of now starting to realize that the most important thing to us is just to make good movies. And, you know, there's a don't fix it if it ain't broken feeling we're having of like, maybe we should just be continuing to do these things in our style and maybe gradually increase that. You know, like, you know, our last movie we shot was called The Dodecapentathlon. It was a little higher budget, and we had a little more crew, and we still maintain that familiarity. And, you know, and then maybe one day we'll be doing what we do and just put kind of more name actors in them so that, you know, there can be better sales for studios, and maybe we'll increase slowly over time. That would be a great thing. It's just to where maybe 15 years from now we're able to do what we do, but everybody can make decent money.
I mean, we really only think about what's the story we want to tell next, and usually that involves a certain step up in terms of the challenge that we're willing to take on, and not just story-wise, but also just, like, production-wise. Like, we're, you know, we do want to take on new challenges, but it does seem incremental. So, but it really just kind of comes down to, like, our philosophy of, like, how we get work through our problems on set, even. And the primary question we ask ourselves is, what do you want to see next? And that's kind of how we function on a larger level, too, is, like, we have five or six movies that are kind of floating around in different forms, different stages of development, different laptops. And usually when we start asking that question, there's only one that we are like dying to make. And that's what we've done so far. So we're going to try and stick with it.
And, what is the new movie about, and when should we look for it?
The one we just shot is called The Dodecapentathlon. And it's about two brothers who compete in their own personal 25-event Olympics, which no one else is invited to attend or watch. And it's sort of our take on the sports movie genre. And, you know, but of course, in our style, it's mostly close-ups and people getting their feelings hurt. So
I always like to end with a question that it's kind of weird, but I like it anyway. And that is, what sort of movies do you think the world needs now?
Funny ones?
I think the world, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say that like a movie is that important in the world, so to speak. But I think in terms of, you know, the business and stuff like that, I think like it would be really, really great if the world could have more movies like Once. I really like what Once did in that it was a low-budget movie that people could access, but it was bereft of any irony and bereft of any sarcasm. It was just pure love, you know, and the way people responded to that, and the way when you meet a stranger and you start talking about Once, you're immediately connected in a way that is not based on making fun of something, but like a love of something. And that's like, that's so pure. I love what that did.
I mean, this is like, we never do anything political, but I do and have thought, I don't know if this will ever come into the realm of what Mark and I do, but I do think that probably the world needs most is like movies that humanize Arabs, or at least the U.S. needs movies that where you're just like watching Arab people and you're like, oh, he's like me. That's
and Arabs need movies that humanize us.
White people.
Yes.
Well, that's going to wrap up this edition of the Plastic Podcast. For more information about this podcast and to see what else we're up to, please visit us on the web at dailyplastic.com. There you can leave us a comment, or if you prefer to leave audio comments so that we hear your voice, just give us a call at 415-287-4020 and leave a message. Don't worry, no one will answer. We'll be back next time with the second half of our summer speed round. That's next time.